Thank you for downloading this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. CFR is an independent national membership organization and nonpartisan research center. For more information, please visit us online at cfr.org.
Good afternoon from New York, and welcome to the Council on Foreign Relations, Religion, and Foreign Policy Conference Call Series. I'm Irina Vasquez, Vice President for the National Program and Outreach here at CFR. As a reminder, today's call is on the record and the audio will be available on our website, www.cfr.org. Before we get started, I wanted to just highlight for you all that we will be co-hosting an event with the Tony Blair Faith Foundation at the American Academy of Religion annual meeting in Chicago this Friday, November 16th from 4 to 6 p.m. And we'll also be exhibiting at the conference. So if you're in Chicago, we hope you will join us either for the meeting on Friday or come stop by our booth. We're delighted to have Joshua Kurlansik with us today. Mr. Kurlansik is CFR's Senior Fellow for Southeast Asia. Most recently, he was a scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where he studied Southeast Asian politics and economics and China's relations with Southeast Asia. Mr. Kurlansik has served as a columnist and correspondent for numerous newspapers, online journals, and magazines, and serves on the editorial board of Current History. He is the winner of the Liu Scholarship for Journalism in Asia, and his book, Charm Offensive, How China's Soft Power is Transforming the World, was nominated for CFR's 2008 Arthur Ross Book Award. And his new book is called Democracy in Retreat, and it will be it's forthcoming, I believe it's a February date, Josh?
January,
okay. So thank you very much for being with us today. We circulated before this call your article, Thailand's secessionist Muslim insurgency escalates, and I think you touched upon the political context and the religious divide in Thailand. It would be great if you could just highlight your article and give us a taste of what's going on there now.
Sure. Thank you to everyone for participating. I read over the roster, and so I must start by saying I'm hardly a religious scholar. Most of the people on this call have far more credentials, either as a religious leader or a religious scholar. So I'd like to just give you a little background about this conflict and talk a little bit about how it emerged, and then maybe we can talk about the way that religion plays in. I would dare say that the insurgency in southern Thailand is probably the least known major war or insurgency in the world. At least, certainly in Asia, it is. You have to remember that this insurgency, which has killed over 5,000 people in the last 10 years, is going on very nearby, you know, only a couple hundred miles away from places that are known worldwide as sort of idyllic beach resorts. They're places where people go on vacation, like Phuket, and that Thailand overall, although it has had a lot of broader political conflict in the last few years, is still overall a relatively well-functioning society and a relatively wealthy country. So we're not talking about an insurgency in the eastern Congo or the north of Uganda. We're talking about an insurgency in one of the wealthier countries in the world and a place that attracts quite a lot of international attention. And yet, for the last 10 years, those three provinces in southern Thailand bordering Malaysia have been just a constant charnel zone day after day of violence. I used to live in Thailand for a number of years and go back a couple times a year. The south has become increasingly dangerous for journalists. And so I want to come back and just give a broad overview of what's going on. The three provinces in southern Thailand closest to the border with Malaysia are the only Muslim-majority provinces in Thailand. The rest of Thailand is primarily Buddhist, about 95% Buddhist. Those provinces were absorbed into Thailand about 100 years ago. So there's always been some degree of separatist sentiment and unhappiness with rule from Bangkok, and a low-lying degree of animosity between Buddhists and Muslims in the south. And there was a low-level insurgency in this area in the 60s and 70s, but low-level. It was not anything like what you have now. Starting about 10 years ago in 2001, all of a sudden, what I would call a high-intensity insurgency burst out of what seemed like nowhere. And it has only spiraled from there. You started to have, at first, attacks on local officials, monks, teachers, and other people who were perceived as symbols of the Thai state who were in the south. That was in the early 2000s. That has sort of expanded into the mid and late 2000s. It's expanded into attacks on any Muslims living in the south who were in any way linked to the Thai state. So that could be just simply people who worked on rubber plantations that were owned by Thai Buddhists, or Muslims who were bus drivers for schools, shopkeepers. And now in the last 3 years, you've seen a basically almost a scattershot approach to just total chaos. There have been multiple attacks in the last few years, and there, the numbers aren't right now. There's at least, there's about 3 to 5 violent attacks, which could be bombings, shootings, or stabbings in these three southern provinces every day. And there's been an increasing number of attacks. There just seem to be for the sake of trying to shut down all law and order in the province. Just shootings into school buses, attacking school buses and shooting children to death, bombing markets, capturing just random poor people who had no links to any government at all, and decapitating them. The level of brutality has increased significantly. So at the same time, the Thai security forces, so that's mostly the army, have since the beginning taken the approach of basically extreme force. And the if the insurgency, and I can get in a second into talking about why this insurgency is so poorly understood, but if the insurgency is all Muslims, I would say, the Thai security forces are almost all Buddhists and have a very limited understanding of the culture of the three southern provinces of Islam, and also of the language that's spoken in these three southern provinces, which is more like Malay than Thai. The security forces basically have taken a strategy of rounding up people, martial law, and also, unfortunately, allying themselves very closely with the Buddhist religious establishment. So a lot of the army camps in the Deep South are actually camped out at monasteries. So you see the jarring sight of you're walking along and you see a monastery, which is usually a very peaceful-looking place in Thailand, with a huge army encampment of machine guns. To be fair, there are a number of monks in southern Thailand who have encouraged that as well. So it has become intermingled in that way also. So that's been the primary response from the army. The third element in Thailand is Thailand has a royal family, but they're not a constitutionally limited royal family like Britain or the Netherlands. And they play an enormous role in Thai life and society and are viewed almost as gods. And they have encouraged Buddhists in the south to sort of fight back against the insurgency by arming themselves with shotguns, by training. And so you have also the potential for a kind of internecine strife ad nauseum in this area. And I would say that also that the government and the security forces have generally failed to understand the idea of diversity in one country. And so they heavily promote the notion that to be Thai means that you have to believe in nation, monarch, and religion. And nation means, it could be a somewhat complex term, but that you're of Thai descent. Monarch means you support the king, and the religion that they refer to is Buddhism. So obviously, at least one, if not all of those things, are very uncomfortable for people in these three southern provinces to adhere to, but yet that message is delivered very strongly. So this insurgency has gotten worse and worse and worse over the last 10 years. And there's been a number of really horrific incidents. There was an incident in 2004 in which young men who were protesting were at a mosque, were rounded up by security forces, tied up, pushed into the back of trucks, and it's really, 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 really damn hot in southern Thailand, like a regular temperature of 110 to 130 degrees Fahrenheit. They were pushed into trucks and left to die there, and 81 or 82 of them suffocated in the trucks. There have been events in which insurgents did similar things. And yet this is an insurgency that gets almost no attention among policymakers in the U.S. or anywhere else in the West. It gets almost no press coverage, or very little press coverage. And it gets some attention from religious organizations, but not much. The Organization of Islamic Conference has tried to play some peacemaking role, or at least some mediating role in the South, very limited. But very little attention if you compare it to some of these other places like Aceh or Sri Lanka, Nepal, Rwanda, other places where Cambodia, where a lot of effort has been put into either ending insurgencies or post-violence reconciliation efforts. This is a place that's been almost completely ignored. And there are several reasons for that, and one of them is that it's a very shadowy insurgency. Compared to something like the Tamil Tigers or the IRA, it's still very unclear in this insurgency in Thailand who is actually leading it. There has been no one who stood up and made clear and unstated demands and could say these demands represent all of the insurgents who are fighting for me. There's also, I think, a very poor understanding, both in the media there and in the foreign media who are able to go there. This is an insurgency that somehow doesn't fit the matrix of that all these insurgencies should necessarily fit into some sort of one global jihad, which is, of course, ridiculous. But this doesn't fit into that. The insurgents have not made any effort to attack Western targets. Like I said, there are very, very, very fancy, wealthy beach resorts that attract many Westerners very nearby, and there's been no attacks on them. And so I think another reason why this has been ignored is that it's been hard for those people who want to sort of fit all these types of insurgencies together to fit this together with it. And that's because it doesn't fit together. The people there have local demands, and there's no necessarily broader overlying issues. The third is Thailand is the United States' treaty ally, one of our oldest treaty allies. And the Thai military is a very, very close friend of the United States. And so we have, as this insurgency has gone on, said very little about it. I don't think that would be the case if this insurgency was going on and there was also the same type of brutal tactics used to put it down, perhaps somewhere else. But in Thailand, because we have a very close and special relationship with Thailand, both the embassy in Bangkok and generally the State Department has said almost nothing about this insurgency. And then finally, the insurgency, I would say, has gotten little attention worldwide because if it doesn't fit into sort of the matrix of the war on terrorism experts, it also doesn't really fit well into the matrix of a lot of kind of peacemaking, peace-building, conflict resolution organizations, including a number of religious organizations. Like I mentioned, the OIC has made some efforts. There have been some efforts by some Dutch Quaker groups. There have been some efforts by some Norwegians. But they've had trouble fitting it into their conflict resolution matrix because there isn't necessarily clear boundaries. There isn't necessarily clear parties who you can bring to a table to try to learn about each other or even mediate. And there isn't clear signals from either side, either security forces or the insurgents, that they have any interest in winding up the fighting anytime soon. So for all those reasons, it doesn't fit into the global war on terror. It doesn't really fit, hasn't really fit well into any conflict resolution organizations. Sort of manual of conflict resolution. It's hard to get to. The U.S. is very quiet about it, and there's no one charismatic leader at the top like an Osama bin Laden or Joseph Kony. This has just gone on. And I can tell you that this is a terrifying place for average people to live on a daily basis. And it is... in fact, on a per capita basis of violent incidents, more dangerous than anywhere in Afghanistan, Iraq, or almost anywhere else in the world. I think I'll stop there because I would love to take questions, and I'm sure people have questions that more about some of the religious aspects of it, which I can try to answer as best I can.
Terrific. Thanks very much. Let's open it up now to questions.
Thank you. At this time, we will open the floor for questions. If you'd like to ask a question, please press the star key, followed by the one key. That's star one on your touch-tone phone now. At any time you would like to remove yourself from the questioning queue, press star two. Again, to ask a question, press star one. Our first question comes from Gavin Gungerich, All Souls.
Josh, thank you for that overview. My question has to do with what's happening within the Muslim community. If you could talk a little bit about what role the insurgency plays within the Muslim community. Is the community as a whole sympathetic, not sympathetic, secessionist, not secessionist? Can you talk a little bit about kind of the internal dynamics and risks within the Muslim community?
Sure. I should say that there are Muslims who live in Thailand outside of these three provinces. There is a small minority in other places. But so overall, I would say in these three provinces, there's always been a latent amount of secessionist feeling. That was diminished in the 80s and 90s by just the general boom in Thailand's economy. Thailand was, for many years, the fastest growing country in the world. And the South did well, too. The South has a lot of good industries, rubber, shrimp. There are some oil and gas. They have a very good tourism industry with Malays coming there. And in addition, during that time period, the Thai government made, I would say, more progressive efforts to try to integrate the three southern provinces into Thailand without subsuming them into the nation, religion, king sort of box. So secessionist sentiment diminished. Secessionist sentiment probably, I would say, now is quite high among the general population. You had, in addition to the killings, you've had a number of peaceful demonstrations where people peacefully walk through the provinces flying the flags of Malaysia or flags of the sultanate that existed 120 years ago. So I think secessionist sentiment is now much higher. But that's for a number of reasons. It's because of the terrible response to the insurgency. It's because Thailand's economy is a lot worse, and those who have suffered the most from it are those who have the least education, which is a lot of people in the south. So while they were doing real well when the economy was booming, they could come to Bangkok and build construction, manual labor was in demand and paying well. They've been hurt very badly by the downturn in the economy. And the third reason is they feel that their own Muslim political representatives, you know, they have a certain number of MPs, have really done little to represent their culture or their distinct language and their distinct needs. In fact, a lot of people view the MPs from the south as a kind of mafia that have served only for years to protect their own interests. So all those things together have contributed to just, I would say, yes, generally a secessionist feeling among those three provinces. But on this, at the same time, and so there is some support for the insurgency. At the same time, in the last few years, the insurgency has targeted mostly Muslims and has unleashed brutal violence mostly against Muslims. And they have made a number of efforts to enforce closing businesses on Fridays and other things through violence. And so the picture is complex. I mean, I think that probably if there was a serious effort by the Bangkok government to provide real autonomy in these three provinces with their own governors, with a lot of their own funds, so that funds from natural resources in these areas went back to these provinces, they might significantly tamp down secessionist sentiment, and then they would be able to possibly go after the insurgency. But as it is now, with the really backwards, poor policy from Bangkok, the secessionist sentiment that exists does feed the insurgency, even though the insurgency is not exactly doing its best for its own PR with Muslim people in the south. If that answers your question.
Yes, thank you.
Thanks, Carolyn. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Rhonda Swam, University of Hawaii.
Let me begin by thanking you. This is very enlightening, and I appreciate the little bit of a talk that you gave. I have two questions try to connect. I'm wondering, the Muslims in the area, do they primarily identify themselves with a particular ethnic group, or are they various ethnic groups that come under the rubric of Islam? And then the second question is, what sect of Islam? Are they a sect of Islam where they're getting outside help, like maybe Shia Islam, and they're getting some help from Iran or Wahhabi or Salafi, and they're getting from Saudi Arabia? Anyway, those are my questions.
Okay. Most of the people in the south, in the three provinces in the south, are ethnically Malay, so that difference is, that's the difference from people in the rest of Thailand who are ethnically Thai. And ethnicity, as much as religion, is the dividing line, and they speak a language called Yawi, which is essentially like the Malay that is spoken in Malaysia and Indonesia. There are plenty of people in the deep in the south who speak Thai too, but a lot of people speak Yawi first or Malay first, and so their Thai tends to be not so great, or they have to work very hard at it, and it makes it harder for them to get into higher education in Bangkok or other places. So they are ethnically Malay, and that is a major part of their identity. Most people in the south are Sunni, but there are other heterodox groups. There has been some effort in the last 15 years to, by several Persian Gulf countries through charities, to fund more extreme Salafi schools in the deep south, and to send some religious teachers. I don't think they've been that successful. There are a couple of schools that are well attended. There are Salafi schools. It's hard to say whether they're well attended simply because the state of school in the deep south is so terrible, and these are pretty well funded schools. But it's not, I wouldn't consider it a great return on the investment. Compared to some other places that Persian Gulf Salafi charities have invested money. I mean, people in the Deep South are not that religiously conservative. And although there has been some Salafi money invested, it hasn't become that much more religiously conservative. I should also say that, you know, those provinces also, even though they have become a little bit more religiously conservative, they still have, and they've become very dangerous, they still have an enormous, enormous sex tourism industry. And so they can't be that religiously conservative and at the same time. There have been efforts, and particularly also, I should say, after 9/11, there were a lot of efforts by a number of American terrorism researchers, or I don't know what you call it, terrorologists, to link Salafi money going to southern Thailand and linking insurgency in southern Thailand to sort of the broader global war on terror, and it just didn't really pan out, and one of the reasons why was the Salafi money hadn't really led to much more extremism in the population. And the insurgents, they have made calls for some more religious conservatism, but again, there's no one leader making one specific call. And a lot of the calls that are put out, either on the internet or through leaflets, have to do with the removal of the sort of instruments of the Thai state less than pushing for more religious conservatism.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. As a reminder, to ask a question, you can do so by pressing star 1. Our next question comes from Easton Wall with American University.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking time out to share about this the situation that, you're right, I hadn't heard of it until the email went out. My question is concerning the nature of the insurgency. There's a couple of keywords that stuck out to me, both in your talk and in your article. Earlier you said that the insurgency was seemingly leaderless. You mentioned it having sort of mafia-esque characteristics, and in your article, at the close of it, you did talk about sort of the nature and culture of young men being brought into that. And all of these things made me think about that this is, I wanted to hear your thoughts on whether this could be more similarly compared to simply gang warfare rather than any kind of organized demand for changes in society. I think about inner city America and some of these issues with socioeconomic opportunities. And if there is very little socioeconomic opportunity in these three provinces in the South, would Islam simply be a shared identity that could be pushed sort of like black identity in the States to push sort of an underground economy because there is so little access to education, things of that sort, on the sex tourism industry perhaps being a part of that? These are all things that I'm curious about the links between them and your thoughts.
Yeah, that's a very good question. There are some similarities. Certainly, there's a significant lack of educational social opportunity in the South, and recruiting for the insurgency emphasizes not only Islam but Malay identity, and it is give you a kind of status potentially that you can't get through legitimate work, which you could get through legitimate work when the economy was booming in the 80s and 90s. So in that way, I see the correlation. It's hard to say that I wouldn't necessarily make the correlation to drug gangs in the U.S. because when I talk about the mafia-type aspect of the insurgency in southern Thailand, there are a number of the insurgent groups that are engaged in drug smuggling and other organized-type crime, but at the same time, some of their complaints is that the previous leaders of the South, the members of Parliament, and other prominent leaders, they themselves were well known to be engaged in a lot of organized crime. So, and also a lot of the army soldiers in the South are engaged in organized crime. In fact, it's been shown time and time again that most of the weaponry used by the insurgents in southern Thailand is weapons that was purchased from corrupt army officers. So the entire three-wage, the entire insurgency, both sides, has some elements of crime overlapping with a political conflict. But I definitely agree with you on the first point that it is seen as a mark of pride, and there are some parallels to the situation you described in the U.S. And if there were other ways to win yourself a mark of pride, the way there were in the 80s and 90s, or there could be other ways. I mean, Thailand's army could be transformed into an army that was really merit-based, the way we have an army that's really merit-based. And it could be then a ladder for people in the South to rise up on. But as it is now, Thailand's army is nothing like that. But I definitely see the social parallels that you're bringing up.
Thank you very much. Right, and then I suppose the piece, and you don't have to answer this question, but the comment that I would give is I feel a conflict between how much of this insurgency is out of a devotion to Islam versus how much of it is simply a reaction to socioeconomic and circumstances.
First of all, you have to tie Islam to Malay identity because that's what they would say. But I don't know that you could necessarily sort that out. But it is true that when the economy was better, there was less of the insurgency. And on the other hand, it's hard to separate these factors out because the insurgency began to bubble up in the early 2000s, and the prime minister at the time and the army, Thaksin Shinawatra, and the army took really inappropriately extremely harsh measures. So possibly had a different approach been taken, it might not have gone out of all control the way it did now. But the old insurgency, which was much smaller level, but in the 60s and 70s, ended largely because wiser Thai politicians at that time, in the late 70s and early 80s, gave an amnesty to all the leaders, really invested in development in the South, and created a record of, for a significant period of time, high growth and growth that filtered down locally. So I certainly believe that there's a fair amount to what you're saying. On the other hand, at this point, I don't know how you can, if you can turn the clock back. And also, although it's a little hard to explain to people who are not Thailand experts, the monarchy in Thailand is far, far more powerful than anything, any monarchy you can imagine. It's more akin to something like Kim Jong-il or Vladimir Putin than it is to Queen Elizabeth. And so there have been unfortunate interventions in the last few years in which members of the royal family have really screwed up efforts at development and peace building in the South. So you have to throw that in, too.
Thank you very much.
Sure. Thanks for your question.
Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Virginia Pierce with Catholic Bishop Conference.
Hi. I guess my question is, to what extent is ASEAN at all involved in this, given the fact that Malaysia and Indonesia are two prominent members, obviously with large Muslim populations, and the Secretary General of ASEAN is from the southern part of Thailand and certainly has played a very prominent role in the guidance of ASEAN. To what extent has he been involved at all in terms of trying to get a resolution to the degree of violence that is taking place in the South?
Yeah, Sirin's not from the three provinces in Deep South, but he is from the South, and he is a Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
That's the Secretary General. Well, since you seem to have a handle on this. You surely also know that ASEAN is an organization that works by consensus. It's not an organization like the Organization of African Unity or the EU, where countries are willing to more aggressively criticize or even insert themselves into other countries. And so the Thais have really, really not wanted outside influence in mediating this. They have, like I said, they have allowed some small efforts by the Dutch, some small efforts by some Norwegian peacemakers, but they have mostly kept ASEAN as an organization out of it. And Surin definitely feels very strongly about the Deep South and has pushed both for a stronger role for the ASEAN Secretary General and the ASEAN Secretariat in mediating the conflict in southern Thailand and just generally in mediating conflict in Southeast Asia. And he's mostly been rebuffed, and he will say that he has said that and will say that, I'm sure, again. There have been some efforts. Thailand and Malaysia meet regularly at the consulate on the Thai side and at the consulate on the Malay side to discuss the insurgency, border issues, people coming back and forth. And there have been some efforts by Malaysia to put forward themselves as a kind of potential mediator. But that's complicated by the fact that there are some groups in the Deep South in Thailand that would like to be part of Malaysia. And so some Thai politicians, some Thai leaders don't trust Malaysia as a mediator. So in short, the answer is ASEAN hasn't done very much, and that is because ASEAN, even with a proactive head like Surin, is limited by the fact that it's an organization that has to get its members' approval to do anything. It's a very weak organization when it comes down to it. Surin would like it to be an organization that was much more aggressive in peace building, and it hasn't. It was never designed to be that, and it still isn't that.
Next question.
Thank you. As a reminder to ask a question, press star 1. Our next question comes from Sheikh Ubaid with the Muslim Peace Coalition.
Hi. Thank you so very much for the overview and the answer that you have given. You know, whereas Malaysia has played a very statesmanlike role by not supporting secession, at least not to an extent that other countries might have in the region, because unlike the Chinese ethnic Muslims in Thailand and the Thai ethnic Muslims, the Muslims in the south were an independent kingdom, so it's more of an ethnic identity with Malaysia rather than with Islam that has led, that was the initial spark, don't you think? And then that followed by the continuous operation has led the flames to spread. So on one hand, while Malaysia has played a good role, the army and the Buddhist monks have not shown an equal level of statesmanship. So what do you think the role of the world should be so that this conflict is not exploited by extremist elements?
What do I think the role of what should be?
The Buddhist monks and the military, which have which have fined from the other side, the operation from the other side, the majority operation.
Well, first, yes, I agree. I think that the Malaysian government, the Najib government, and the Abdullah government before him have played a pretty moderate statesman-like role. They haven't encouraged the insurgency, certainly not. I think that the Malaysian government, the Thais would argue the Malaysian government hasn't done enough to try to police people coming across the border and going back and forth across the border. I don't know if that has less to do with just simply the resources, limited resources of Malaysia when they have other challenges, and it's a very big spread out country. I do think that they've generally played a statesmanlike role, but I also think that particularly now when Malaysia is in election season, that and the prime minister needs to really, really, really win a huge majority of Malay votes in Malaysia because he's facing an opposition that's going to take most of the Chinese and Indian votes, it would be very unlikely and unpopular for him to go around cracking down on even violent insurgents who cross the border into Malaysia who are Malay. So it's political on both sides of the border. As to Thai military and Thai monkhood, the military, the Thai military has been pretty much for a long time essentially an armed bureaucracy. They don't really fight wars with other countries. They exist to fight for power, and control politics within Thailand, most recently with a coup in 2006. So you have an army that's not really well trained for anything other than that, even though they do get a lot of joint training with the U.S. So even if you were going to say that they were, even if one supported very harsh counterinsurgency tactics in this area, the Thai army is not trained to even do those, let alone cultural understanding and the type of gaining support from the local population that you would also need. So for this military to effectively operate in what is now one of the most dangerous environments in the world, you would need a radical overhaul, and dramatic shift and huge infusion of funds for different things in the Thai military. And I see that as almost that the chances of that are nil, I'm sorry to say. And that's because several reasons. While the insurgents in southern Thailand are not linked to any sort of global movement, and they have not targeted Western interests, or they have not targeted Bangkok, as a result, most people in Bangkok, which is where the political power is in Thailand, they just don't care. Because to them, it's some carnage that's on a TV screen 1,000 miles away, but it never affects them. And so there's not a lot of pressure from what I would call liberal, progressive society in Bangkok, whether that's media, liberal Buddhist groups, even liberal Muslim groups in Bangkok for a different army policy in the south, because it doesn't affect them. Secondly, changing the army's approach and the monkhood's approach is very, very challenging because it all comes under the hand of the king. And since Thailand has the harshest laws in history about criticizing the king, even if someone had really good ideas on how the monkhood could be reorganized to reduce the rise of more nationalist monks and to make the selection of more senior monks more apolitical, doing that might come up against those harshly majestic laws, and so people are reluctant to do anything. That said, the king in Thailand is likely to die sometime quite soon, in the next few years, and it's possible that will open the floodgates to a lot of things, including a reorganization of the monkhood, a reorganization of the army, and so it's possible that some of those roadblocks will be lifted. But right now, I'm sorry to be so negative, but yeah, I don't see that the harsh but also ineffective tactics used in southern Thailand are going to change anytime soon.
So can I ask a follow-up question?
Sure.
Since the progressive Thai elements as well as the Buddhist clergy is not taking any step and the monarchy is also not interested, What is the role of the United States, especially from the geopolitical point of view, that we are always talking about war against terror? Because this continuous operation and upheaval in southern Thailand is going to alienate Muslims and make them more inclined towards extremism in neighboring Malaysia as well as in Indonesia. Because if you look at the historic background in the 1896 Anglo-French Declaration, where the boundaries were demarcated, and also 1909 Anglo-Thai Agreement, the Muslims of southern, what turned out to be southern Thailand were never asked whether you want to be part of Thailand. So it's only natural that they have this nationalist tendencies, and to call them bandits or to call them Al-Qaeda and try to oppress them is not going to solve. So what is the role that the State Department and the U.S. Ambassador and the U.S. military strategists...
What is the role of the State Department and the U.S. military regarding the insurgency in southern Thailand?
Yeah, to put pressure on the Thai government to find an amicable, peaceful solution.
Okay. Well, first of all, I just want to say that there was effort to try to link them to Al-Qaeda after 9/11, but I do think that at this, by now, even the people who are the most sort of invested in the idea of a global war on terror have agreed that the insurgency in southern Thailand is not related to Al-Qaeda. So the Thai government basically told the U.S., both State Department officials and military, hands off southern Thailand. We don't want you there. We don't want any cooperation there. We don't want any help there. And I believe that that's pretty much accurately what's been done. On the other hand, you can make the argument that, United States and Thailand together have enormous joint military training exercises every year. They are a major purchaser of U.S. weaponry. We have very, very close nil-nil relations. And should we have such close nil-nil relations with a military that is affecting such harsh tactics, not only in southern Thailand, but 2 years ago on the streets of Bangkok, killed quite a number of protesters. So there's certainly an argument that the deep U.S.-Thai nil-nil relationship should be reevaluated. And you do have some people on Capitol Hill who have started to question that. But in terms of in southern Thailand, there is not a U.S. military presence. I'm sure there is some CIA collecting of information. U.S. diplomats go there occasionally, but certainly they don't go there that often, and there are others who go there far off, more often, like the Dutch and the Australians. And basically, the U.S. has gone along with the Thai government's request over the last 10 years to basically stay out of southern Thailand. You could debate whether maybe things would be worse if the U.S. had been more involved there, but certainly there is a lively debate now among on Capitol Hill and among people who follow Thailand on about whether we should continue to have such a close nil-nil relationship with the Thai armed forces.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. There are no further questions at this time. Irina, do you have any closing comments?
Josh, I think I can just turn it over to you if there are any things you want to wrap up with. We're almost at the end of our hour.
Well, first of all, I thank you. This has been very enlightening to me. The only thing I would like to wrap up with, which we had a session on the insurgency at CFR last week. The only thing I would wrap up with is I would say is that if you are concerned about this, a lot of people perhaps haven't heard about this before, but if you are concerned about it, one of the reasons why a place like Thailand or a situation like this is goes on for so long and is unchanged is because Thailand falls somewhere between the kind of big world issues and issues that get completely ignored. And so, for example, China or Israel, you have thousands, hundreds of thousands of people weighing in on policy, and they tend to counterbalance each other in various ways, and hopefully, if they don't make for a more nuanced policy in the U.S., they at least provide a lot of input into it. By contrast, if you have a place like, you know, I don't know, Belize, there's probably almost no policy making. Thailand falls somewhere in the middle. So you have a very small number, a small handful of people in D.C. who do follow Thailand and provide input into policy making. And because of that, it can be dominated by a very small number of people providing input into policy making. So I would end with only by saying is that this insurgency or this issue just generally is not one that, should you take an interest, is impenetrable for a religious leader or a religious group from the U.S. to get involved in and or to play a role in, simply because it is pretty obscure, and there is space for other voices. People are not drowning out other voices in the policy debate on Thailand in Washington. There's probably about 20 people. I know them all. And people do welcome other voices, and this is certainly a situation in which outside religious groups could and are certainly at some point going to have to play a larger role when they finally agree to put their guns down. And to this point, there really has been little effort of that type. And I understand it is dangerous to go there, but and the Asia Foundation has brought some religious leaders there, but there's been little effort. So this is something that matters a lot to me, and I do think that there is room for American religious groups to play a larger, potentially play a larger mediating effort there. That's all else I would say.
Josh, well, thank you for that that closing comment and for this call and to everybody who participated in your comments. I just want to also tell people that Josh is maintains a blog on our website, the CFR blog, Asia Unbound, with other Asia experts. So I hope that you will follow his writing and his posts there. It's on the homepage of our website, www.cfr.org.
There's plenty of Thailand stuff there.
And yes, so please feel free to go there, comment, contribute to the discussion. We'd love that. To that end, we also hope that you will please send us your ideas and topics for our continuing conference call series for the Religion and Foreign Policy Initiative. The email address is outreach@cfr.org, and as all of you know from having been part of this initiative, we're trying to connect religious and congregational leaders and scholars in cross-denominational conversations on a broad range of pressing international issues. So we hope that you'll give us feedback and suggestions. Our next call will be in early December, and will feature CFR Adjunct Fellow Reza Oslin, who will talk about Iran. We will send the invitation after the Thanksgiving holiday, so please look for that. Again, thank you, Josh Kalantic, for today's call, and we look forward to reading your book that's coming out in January.
All right, thanks everyone for participating.
Thank you for listening to this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. For additional audio, video, and transcripts of CFR meetings, as well as expert analysis of international news, please visit us online, cfr.org.